This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Today, we're off to one of the less glamorous places in the region. It's a bathroom in Santa Monica.
We are standing in front of the foam flush toilet restrooms on the level 3 of the City Hall East building. Foam flush toilets, which means it uses foam instead of water, and then it composts in the basement.
I'll bet you're thinking, ew, really? Well, these foam flush toilets in Santa Monica's new City Hall building are also known as compost toilets, and they just may be the answer to one of the biggest water wasters in this dry, drought-prone climate.
The biggest waste in wastewater is the fact that we're using fresh water to transport sewage.
That's Ed Osan with the Natural Resources Defense Council. Well, compost toilets, which use 3 tablespoons of water per visit instead of 1.6 gallons, are going to be open for business at Santa Monica's new City Hall East building come spring. It's a building designed to reduce every kind of waste. And KCRW's Francis Anderton and Kaylee Wells bring us a story of that building as part of our series, Wasted, Neat Solutions to the Dirty Problem of Waste.
Hi, I'm Francis. City Hall East sits off of 4th Street near the 10 Freeway. You enter into a large lobby with views onto a shared courtyard.
And I'm Kaylee. And Francis, what's intriguing about this building is the city of Santa Monica designed it with 2 ambitious goals, maximum sustainability and civic openness.
And this building symbolizes that by being a glass building. It's transparent. It invites you to participate and it expresses, shows you, reveals what's going on.
That's the architect Fred Fisher. And yes, every wall is almost entirely made of glass.
Which makes it so light inside, which you would think would be a big waste of energy in a so-called sustainable building.
But it's a special glass. It's got light-blocking coatings to protect against UV rays. City Hall East is aiming to be certified as what's called a living building.
That's, by the way, the highest sustainability rating possible, even higher than LEED.
Correct. And City Hall East is designed to generate its own energy and to waste no water by emulating nature.
You know, a flower relies on the energy from the sun to grow. It relies on the water that falls within its footprint. And the building's trying to do the same thing.
That's Julian Parsley, lead engineer. And here are the architects, Fred Fisher and Joseph Coriarty.
The building is, in many ways, it's breathing and digesting and producing food.
And it's related to the wellness. We think that a most sustainable building is a building that you feel really good being in. The air quality, the movement of ventilation, the light quality.
So the building is cooled with openable windows, as well as mechanical ventilation. And it has solar panels on the roof and on the carport.
We're actually net metering back and forth with the grid. So as long as we produce more energy than our buildings consume, it's considered a net zero energy building.
And that was Amber Wishane. She's with the Public Works Division at the city.
Okay, but Francis, I want to get to the really interesting part here, which is the water systems.
I somehow thought you'd ask about that, Kaylee. And yes, indeed, there is a whole system of water conservation. They harness rainwater from the roof and recycle it for drinking. They capture grey water from showers and use it to irrigate their edible garden.
And then, of course, there are the compost toilets. Here's Julian Parsley.
The composting toilets were really selected because they drive down the water use so far. And then we also get the benefit of beneficial reuse of the compost within the project or within the city.
And by the way, if you're having a hard time imagining human waste having any sort of beneficial reuse, we understand.
But here's what they're doing. They plan to use the compost right here in the courtyard, nourishing those edible plants. It's very low tech.
Yeah, low tech is right, Francis. Letting nature break down waste is pretty much the oldest method in the world. In the old days, they were called outhouses. We replaced them with modern plumbing, but you can still find them at campgrounds.
However, you probably did not expect to find them in an urban office building. Around 200 city staffers are about to move into City Hall East, and not all of them are eager to be lab rats in a fairly novel experiment to reduce municipal water use. Amber Reshane has the task of telling people that it's all going to be okay.
This is our number one sticking point with our staff. I'd say the open office is a very, very close second, but this is the one that, how am I going to go to the bathroom? And you're like, it's a normal toilet. It just has foam in the bowl instead of water.
So Francis, you checked out that restroom on the third floor. I mean, we got to talk about that.
Well, yes, Kaylee, and what an adventure that was. But I can report that I used the bathroom and the toilets did appear normal and very clean, except there is no flush and no water in the bowl, and that was a little unnerving.
Ooh, what's appearing now from the rim of the bowl is foam, like washing up liquid bubbles, and it's oozing down the side of the toilet.
Now, I have to say the foam did seem a bit feeble, and I couldn't help wondering how it would deal with the big stuff. But Reshane assured me that the combo of foam plus gravity does the trick.
Okay, so that's probably enough info on that. But speaking of gravity, you followed that toilet system back down into the bowels of the building.
Oh, very funny, Kaylee.
Yes, with Amber Reshane as your guide.
That's right.
And we'll enter into the compost room. Oh, there it is. So there are six composters. They basically look like very, very large worm bins, and they function almost identically. They have wood chips in them. They have the waste material from the foam flush toilets above on all three floors. They get maintenanced under when it's full usage once a month. And basically all you do is you turn on an additional fan, you open up that black hatch, there's a very long rake, and you rake it until it's smooth like batter, not layered like a lasagna. And that's it. That's your whole maintenance of the plumbing system, is that.
So having made this kind of mulchy soil, then what do you do with it? Does it just sit there?
It stays there. It'll take about 18 months to 24 months to process through. Then it'll come out here, and we'll have compost.
And you said that you're using the forces of Mother Nature. Mm-hmm. What are those forces?
Well, gravity to get it down, right? And then there's actually worms and bugs and beetles that will actually do the decomposition. So that's another, you know, force of Mother Nature, that those bugs come in and burrow their little holes and aerate and get that natural process of composting going. And then we end up with good, healthy, rich earth.
That sounds great, but Francis, of course, I'm really curious. Does it smell?
I knew you'd ask, Kaylee. And what surprised me was that it really didn't. And that's because I learned it's an aerobic or aerated system. Here's the engineer, Julian Parsley, to explain it.
The air is actually pulled through the water closet, down the tube, and then back out the top of the compost bin. That keeps the smell out of the restrooms. And you're constantly pulling air out of the compost bin. So it's very well ventilated.
Now, these compost toilets may, of course, be the showstopper. But we should say they are part of a comprehensive mechanical and engineering design that is getting plenty of plaudits for its sustainability.
And the green industry loves it. Here's Ben Stapleton. He's executive director with the U.S. Green Building Council.
I'd argue it's probably the greenest municipal building in the world. Really addressing waste from the top down.
So you might be wondering why we're not seeing more buildings like this.
Very good question, Kaylee. And we should start with the price. The city of Santa Monica paid $75 million for this building. And even those compost toilets alone cost thousands of dollars apiece.
Now, the city says it's a worthwhile long-term investment. For one, they own the building, and it's designed to last 100 years. But there's other reasons, too. Ben Stapleton says you have to persuade clients and building contractors to work with unfamiliar materials and systems. Then there's the fact that waste has never been a major concern.
When it comes to our buildings, I think a lot of us have been looking at zero net energy, zero carbon. You know, zero waste is part of the footprint of our buildings, but I don't think that's taken the same sort of priority and focus as some of these other items have.
So waste has not been treated as top priority, but then there's this other issue, and that's the issue that Amber Reshane has been tasked with dealing with, public expectations.
Also known as the yuck factor.
which we spoke about with Ed O'San. He's a senior policy analyst at the Natural Resources Defence Council. He happens also to be working on a concept for a waterless toilet with the Bill Gates Foundation.
And he told us he's all for compost toilets, but believes they won't get widespread acceptance unless a certain condition is met.
Unless the, you might call it the user experience, for want of a better term, is comparable to what we would expect in a public place, in a public restroom, and in your own home. That is a challenge, and that should be a design objective.
And that made us wonder, would the designers of City Hall East themselves put compost toilets in their homes?
I asked lead engineer Julian Parsley. He said that he's a true believer in composting to deal with all kinds of waste. But in his home, he's not the decider.
I think I'd have a hard time convincing my family. If it was just me alone, I think I would.
That was Julian Parsley and the design team at the Net Zero City Hall East in Santa Monica.
For more information on the building and the tours of its compost toilets, go to our website, kcrw.com/greaterLA.
For KCRW, I'm Frances Anderton.
And I'm Kaylee Wells. Next week, we follow the journey of a strawberry. Will she make it from farm to fork or end up in the landfill?
Moving on with KCRW's Greater LA, I'm Steve Chiotakis, and now to the COVID-19 crisis and President Biden's efforts to ramp up vaccinations in his first 100 days. The outgoing administration didn't have much of a distribution plan, which in turn caused a lot of confusion among states concerning the number of vaccines they could expect and if you're able to get them. But what's really happening on the ground for local doctors trying to administer those doses? Dr. Abe Malkin is here to explain what he's been experiencing. He's the founder and CEO of Concierge MD LA, which is a house call medical service. Dr. Malkin, welcome.
Nice to be with you.
You don't currently have a vaccine, right?
I don't. We've gone through a number of steps now to apply to be a vaccine administrator, which following all the guidelines, but yet we have still yet to receive the vaccine. We've followed up a number of times with the health department. And just this morning, we heard that we are under review and are hoping to, practices like ours will be hoping to get the vaccine soon. So it's been a wait and see game, and we're at the mercy of the health department at this point.
Well, tell us about that process to even be certified to administer the vaccine. What do you have to go through?
So there's multiple steps, and to be perfectly transparent, the getting the information about how to even apply was difficult. We had to do a lot of research on our own. I know that there are public information available. However, it's hard to find and difficult to navigate. But we eventually did navigate the process and have applied through a multi-step process, part of which it involves applying to the health department, showing roles of patients in under our care, displaying the ability to administer the vaccine, including cold storage requirements.
So you had to go buy freezers and like special equipment to be able to do this, right?
That's correct. We've gone through a painstaking process now of ensuring that we'll be able to offer the vaccine, and now we're just waiting to receive it.
You're a concierge service, so that means you charge. You make house calls, as it were. And you have members who are a part of your practice. What percentage of those total patients would you say have actually gotten the vaccine?
So unfortunately, very few of our patients have been able to get the vaccine, as others in the country have had to deal with that reality as well. It really varies from county to county. In some counties, public vaccine administration has been a lot looser. However, in Los Angeles County, there's been a much tighter control of vaccine distribution, and it's been really difficult for people to get the vaccine, even publicly. So, you know, I'm dealing with a patient population who are very careful about their health. They prioritize their health and are willing to pay a premium for it. And unfortunately, it's been difficult to deliver the vaccine to them during this uncertain time.
How would you characterize the vaccine rollout from a federal or even state and local level? You're a doctor. I mean, you're the one who has to administer these vaccines. How's it been for you?
You know, what's frustrating is I get the sense that although it's admirable that the government is taking a very careful approach to vaccine distribution. At the end of the day, this is a public health issue, and the more people that get vaccinated, the better in order to get us to herd immunity. So in some ways, I just wish they would loosen the restrictions so that we can get the vaccine into the arms of more people and not worry so much about who's getting it first, but just getting the vaccine out as quickly as possible so that we can achieve that herd immunity as fast as we can, because ultimately that will be better for the public health.
Eventually, you're going to be giving this vaccine, obviously, but you're also administering COVID tests to your patients. And there are a couple of tests that you offer, the rapid test and the PCR. The PCR test is the one with the Q-tip up your nose. We've heard anecdotal stories of people having private parties during the pandemic, and they're hiring doctors to administer on-site rapid tests. Have you done that sort of thing?
We certainly have. And you know, both tests are administered with a nasal swab. You know, I'll say that the PCR test has a higher accuracy rate. And for someone making medical decision making, that can be really important. You know, in a setting where someone's having antigen testing, rapid testing at their event or a party or otherwise, you know, the goal there is to screen patients as effectively as possible. And, you know, PCR tests obviously need to be sent to a lab and have a wait time requirement, whereas antigen rapid tests give a result on the spot. So I admire people and I applaud them for taking the steps to try and have events as safely as possible. And, you know, although antigen tests are not 100% accurate, they do catch quite a few positive cases. And the goal here, again, as we learn to live with COVID and try to resume normal life with the understanding that COVID may be here to stay for a while, is let's do the best we can. And if that means using antigen tests that aren't 100% accurate, at least they're catching quite a few of the cases and helping prevent the spread of, and reduce the transmission as much as possible.
Yeah, but shouldn't you be telling people just cool it? I mean, any COVID activity or possible super spreader event is bad, right?
So I think there's always nuance in every conversation. And unfortunately, in our political environment, everything's black and white. So, you know, obviously, there are some events where it's not helpful and probably shouldn't happen. But there are certainly events where, you know, as part of normal life, people are social beings and need to interact. And I don't think it's helpful to shun people that want to interact with others in a safe way. And, you know, the goal of testing is to reduce the transmission rates of COVID. You know, this is an exponential growth virus, which is why it's so much more harmful than the flu. Where one person gets COVID, more than one other person will get it, which means the R-naught number is greater than one. Whereas the flu, for every several people that get the flu, one person gets it. So it doesn't grow exponentially. And if we can use testing as a way to reduce that R-naught number and allow people to congregate more safely, I support it.
Dr. Abe Malkin, founder of Concierge MD LA. Doctor, thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. Anytime.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. We've talked a lot on this program about how hard restaurants and bars have been hit during the pandemic. Many have gone out of business, and more will close their doors for good before the economy can get up and running again. Well, one thing that could help speed the growth of new restaurants is doing away with some of the bureaucracy, the red tape. Well, last week, the city council, the LA City Council, said it's going to do something about that. And here to tell us more is Mona Holmes, our regular and, of course, a reporter with Eater LA. Hey, Mona.
Hi, Steve.
Typically, we know the restaurant approval process is pretty long and complicated, but during the pandemic shutdown, the city acted pretty quickly to loosen some restrictions to try to help restaurants, right? I mean, talk about some of the things that have changed.
Well, it was a bit of a shock hearing from ABC or the Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control, who doesn't change at all. They're pretty strict. And suddenly they just changed the regs in allowing restaurants and bars to sell cocktails, wine, and beer to go as long as they paired with a food vendor. Everyone loved it, still loves it. And then there was Mayor Garcetti's Alfresco program, and that launched in May. This whole program allowed restaurants to turn public sidewalks, parking lots, any adjacent areas into outdoor dining for no cost. And I mean, it was a bit of a shock because usually these kind of things just don't happen that quickly.
The changes are temporary, obviously, Mona. So last week, the city council passed a motion that doesn't actually change any rules, but it says let's study how or if we should make some of these changes permanent. Is that right? So these aren't for forever.
No, unfortunately. And the really good question is why. But what they're doing is just asking for just city departments to just take a look and just make some recommendations. And that also includes streamlining the sidewalk dining permit process from the Bureau of Engineering. They also want the Department of Transportation in LA to look at, you know, you might have noticed how there's these food pickup zones throughout the city where, you know, a car can just pull right in, hop right out and grab a to-go order from a restaurant. They want them to look at that. And they also want the police commission to accept permit applications that allow live music or dancing. Of course, this is all very contingent upon certain things with COVID, you know, but they're looking at a lot of things. Also, what they want the fire department to streamline the process around outdoor tents, canopies, awnings, all of these things that were previously very pricey and would take a long time for approval.
You talked about the sidewalks and al fresco dining. We don't have that right now because of this latest surge, but it's a pretty popular idea, as is, as you mentioned, the drinks to go part of this as well. Are those under consideration? I mean, how tough would it be to make those rule changes permanent?
Well, everyone loved the change with ABC. Who doesn't love getting cocktails delivered straight to your doorstep? And unfortunately, when I spoke to ABC in the spring, they were very specific to say that this was temporary. This was a COVID-related thing. And because ABC is very stringent in their rules and don't make a lot of changes to their policies, I'm not particularly optimistic about that, but I am optimistic about the Alfresco program. You know, when restaurants were able to just fill out an application and just immediately get approved on the spot, it was pretty festive and amazing for everyone to see all this outdoor activity when we were still allowed to eat outdoors. And I think with a very progressive and new city council, they might look at changes like this, hence this new initiative. So I think the possibility, if you had to choose between the two, would be more towards alfresco dining becoming more permanent than getting booze delivered to your house on a permanent basis.
But again, it's like you said, it's let's study the possibilities, right? Let's look forward and see if there's something that we could do. There's not a whole lot of permanence here. It just seems like they're going to look at it. I mean, who's going to be following up on that?
There have been restaurant owners, consultants, and actual people within the city of Los Angeles that want to try and eliminate some of this red tape. They acknowledge that there is a problem. And we're going to have to wait a few months right now for these agencies and these bodies to get it together. But there are things that that restaurants could do now, that the city could actually do now. They could eliminate zoning parking requirements. You know, there's all kinds of things, these little things that one consultant that I spoke with said could easily save thousands of dollars for restaurants right now at no cost to taxpayers that would just require just a pen on paper with changing a few policies to make all of this red tape, which is pretty extensive in Los Angeles if you own a restaurant, just go away immediately.
And we have to get through the crisis, of course. Mona Holmes, always great to hear from you. Reporter for Eater LA, of course, a regular contributor right here. Mona, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
That's all the time we have. Next week, it's about to be a year since LA lost Kobe Bryant. Can you believe it? A year? What it's been like trying to memorialize him during a year of fast-spreading virus. And you heard today, just now, about restaurants having such a hard time. Next week, a look at gay bars. They're safe spaces for so many folks, but this pandemic shut them all down, and a few of them here in Greater LA are on a path to going away forever. We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Subscribe to the podcast and tell us how you're doing too. You have so much to think about, you can share it with us. KCRW.com/GreaterLA. Thanks to Jenna Cagle, Sonia Geis, Kat Yore, Chuck P., Mario Saavedra, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl for making this evening's show happen. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Please stay safe. Have a great night.